we discuss the pandemic's effect on children's mental health and the alarm bells from the medical community about the rise in depression, self-harm, and suicide. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Please be mindful of the nature of this conversation and do take care. U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy testified before a Senate Finance Committee hearing in February, framing the struggle of children's mental health.
It's not just the unfathomable number of deaths or the instability. It's also the pervasive sense of uncertainty and the nagging sense of fear.
Courtesy C-SPAN, join in with your experiences and questions about youth in crisis, 800-642-1234. Michelle Pickett is an emergency medicine physician at Children's Wisconsin and an associate professor of pediatrics at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Pickett, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
You talked with 60 Minutes recently saying you've seen a lot of young patients attempting suicide, and you've been with Children's Wisconsin for a decade now. What has changed over time? What are you seeing?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing a lot more kids who come in with both suicidal ideation and suicide attempts. And it's really increased over the past couple of years. I think a big part of it has to do with the pandemic. I also think that social media plays a role with it. I do know that in general, I think mental health is being talked about more, which is a great thing. So I think some of the suicidal ideation patients we are seeing are more open to tell their parents and more open to seek help, which is great. They're coming to see us. But in general, we're seeing just a lot more attempts and ideation.
Do these patients have any commonalities that you see, or is each case very different from one to the next?
They're different. It used to be mainly teenagers. Unfortunately, we are seeing younger kids come in now, but we're seeing kids of all different races, ethnicities, backgrounds. They come in and they need help. That's kind of the one common denominator that they have.
So they're coming from all walks of life. Why are these adolescents presenting at the ER in a mental health crisis at all? Why the ER?
Because we're always here and we're always available and we see everybody. Unfortunately, and this is not just in Wisconsin, but everywhere in the U.S., we don't have enough mental health resources as our nation needs. It can be hard to get into appointments on an outpatient basis because our therapists are booked and they're booked out. So it can be challenging. But the ER is a place that you can always turn to for anything, and we are there to help them when they need their help. So while it's not the most ideal situation, it's a, you know, we're there to help.
I think of the ER for physical health emergencies, and now you see your patients, you know, with mental health emergencies in these ER patient rooms. And Children's Wisconsin also has a mental health walk-in clinic, I understand, with some same-day care for children experiencing mental health issues. Has this type of setup, has this clinic helped?
It's definitely helped. It's a great resource that we now have. It's been open not too long, and they're seeing more kids, I think, than they expected to see. But it's still not enough to take the strain off of the emergency department. So we are still definitely seeing kids. Since the 60-minute segment aired, I've been kind of paying more attention to how many kids I'm seeing on my shifts. And there has been, every night I've been there, at least two kids per shift, except for one night, that have been there for suicidal ideation or suicide attempt. And because our inpatient facilities are so strained, so full, and don't have the capacity, we have to admit these kids to the hospital to wait if they're not safe to go home until they can really get the help that they need.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about youth mental health with Dr. Michelle Pickett, who's an emergency medicine physician at Children's Wisconsin, as we look at the situation around adolescent mental health in crisis. And you can call in with your questions and experiences, 800-642-1234. What does the screening process look like for children at risk of self-harm? How do you screen for that in the ER?
Yeah, so we screen every kid 10 years and older for their suicide risk. We started the program back in 2018. And we do it on a tablet because we know that kids are going to be more likely to answer honestly on a tablet than maybe verbally asking them the questions, especially when there are others in the room. So we hand the kid the tablet, and it has five questions. If they answer yes to one of the four questions, they get that fifth question. This is a publicly available tool. It's called the Ask Suicide Screening Questionnaire, or Ask Suicide Screening Questions. It's four simple questions. They answer them, and then those answers are automatically sent in real time to their electronic medical record. If a kid screens positive, then an alert pops up when the provider enters their chart, and we can see exactly how they answered each question and why they had a positive screen. And a positive screen would be yes to anything. Then as providers, our job is to go and assess those kids and to kind of see what is going on. One of the questions on the screen that we ask says, have you ever tried to kill yourself in the past? So we do know that some kids will, you know, have, and if you have, they will always be positive, but it could be years ago and they might not be in that state of mind anymore and not need any additional help. We also know that some kids do have some kind of chronic thoughts of suicide, but there's nothing cute and there's no changes and they're getting all the resources that they need. So our job as the providers is to go and talk to them and their families and kind of see what's going on, where they're at. Do they need help? We gauged how worried we are about them, how worried the parent is about their child, how worried the child is. And if any of us feel that this family and child need more help, then we go and consult our social workers. And in our emergency department, our social workers are really our kind of front line for mental health care. So we'll consult them. They will come and see the patient and the family and do their assessment and evaluation. And then based off of that, we create a plan for the family and a disposition, whether that includes needing just some resources so they can kind of get hooked into our outpatient systems, or if they need something more intense right then and there, we work on kind of the inpatient stuff and trying to get them to an inpatient facility.
Dr. Pickett, do you think you would miss a lot without this tablet-type screening as a way to alert the provider?
Oh, absolutely. We see lots of kids who are coming to our emergency department with complaints that are completely unrelated to mental health care that are screening positive. So those are the kids that we would never know if we didn't ask. But most of the kids who are screening positive on our screen are coming for other reasons.
Talking with Dr. Michelle Pickett in the ER at Children's Wisconsin, that is in Milwaukee, as we hear about the devastating mental health toll in our country's young people. Join in on these difficult questions around suicide, around self-harm, anxiety, and depression for the doctor. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Dr. Pickett here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the mental anguish, the struggle that children and teens are experiencing, and what can be done about the youth mental health crisis. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our State Office of Children's Mental Health found in 2019, mind you, this is data before the pandemic set in, 60% of Wisconsin's high school students experienced depression, anxiety, self-harm, or suicidal ideation. Parents, teachers, teens, join in and please take care with this topic. 800-642-1234. Dr. Michelle Pickett works in emergency medicine at Wisconsin Children's and is sharing her perspective with us for about 10 more minutes. Dr. Pickett, when you think about it in the ER, you see that patient in a really brief moment of their journey back to regaining health, and you might have seen them at a really difficult moment. You always see them, at a difficult moment in the ER. Do you ever wonder what becomes of these young patients who test, you know, who test positive in the suicidal screening, what the true outcomes are like long after they've moved out of your ER for care?
Oh yeah, we always wonder, you know, what happens to our patients when they leave. You know, my hope is that they can get the help they need and the resources that they need to go on and, you know, not have these thoughts and not have to struggle and be in pain and be sad. But unfortunately, being in the ER, I don't always get to find out the outcomes like that.
Children's Wisconsin has mental and behavioral health patient navigators who are following up, supporting families after a positive screening. What do navigators report back on their follow-ups?
Yeah, so this is a newer program that we have. And what they will do is after a patient has gone home, they will contact the family in the next couple of days and see how they're doing, see where they're at in getting the help that they need and the care they need, and work with them to see what we can do to make that process easier. Because it is a hard process to kind of navigate the healthcare system. So they're specialized in that, and we'll just touch base and see what we can do to help them.
So touching base with the family, with the parent, with the guardian, you know, we haven't really talked about the support system around this young person. How are your conversations with family members when you have a suicide screening that gives off some, you know, warning signs?
Yeah, in general, there's kind of two different ways those conversations go. You know, sometimes this is a known concern and a known issue. So those parents are already aware that their kid has had these thoughts or has had an attempt in the past. The other ones, though, this is completely new and this is the first time that they're hearing it, and they're devastated. They're absolutely devastated to hear that their kid feels this way. A lot of them, you know, they say, I had no idea. And, you know, without screening them, they might not know if this isn't something that is communicated often at home. I do remember there when we started the screen a few years ago, I had a child. I think she was younger, 11-ish. And, you know, I spoke with her first in private, and she was with her dad, and she didn't want her dad to know. And she was so scared to tell him because she didn't want to make him mad. And, you know, I assured her that definitely wouldn't happen. So I stepped out and I talked with her dad, and he broke down crying that her daughter felt this way and was heartbroken, you know, that she felt like she couldn't tell him that she needed help and was having these thoughts. And it's hard to watch. It's heartbreaking to watch, but it is it's a good conversation starter, and it's a way to open up those lines of communication going forward amongst those parents and their children.
How do you get these questions in more forums than just the ER? How do you get this screening to be used elsewhere?
Yeah, so the screening can be used kind of in any medical setting. We are also doing it in our inpatient setting, and we're working on extending it to our outpatient clinics. My goal would be to do screening in other settings outside of just the medical setting, you know, potentially schools, you know, places where kids are going. I've been in communication with a local school district, and we're hoping that we can kind of go forward and try to pilot that, but nothing official yet.
So when you say with like a local school district, that this screening might be available at the school nurse, or how would you envision it in functioning in a school setting?
Yeah, you know, it would require an undertaking. You'd have to make sure you have all the resources in place so when kids do screen positive, that we can talk to them kind of right then and there and get the resources that they need. But, you know, this screening, it can be done on paper where you could hand it to kids. They could also have a link on their Chromebooks where they could do it and where those answers could kind of be seen in real time and be able to discuss with the kids who screen positive and, you know, contact their families and see where do we need to go from here.
I'm wondering if what you see in the ER is informing how and what you teach future doctors, how you look at your classes on pediatric care.
Definitely it is. You know, when I was in medical school, this is not something that we talked about a lot, you know, in my pediatric rotations, for sure. But now, you know, we have our residents and our students come through, and I'm always looking, say, hey, make sure your kids, you know, were screened for suicide. And I'm able to then, when we do have a kid with positive screen, able to talk to that resident and kind of talk them through, now here's what we do. Here's how you talk to the family about it. Here's the approach I use. And they're able to develop those skills. So when they're off practicing independently, they can hopefully incorporate this into their practices too.
They're really learning on the job though. And as you mentioned earlier, every case, every experience is unique and different. And so I would imagine that even for you as a physician who sees this a lot, that you have to be open and be willing to continue to learn what might be possible or how you should be reacting in situations.
Oh yeah. We learn something new every day. You know, and sometimes situations don't go as I would like them to. And, you know, not everyone is receptive to getting care and seeking care, which is always challenging. You know, and as a doctor though, I have to work with the family and kind of, you know, come to a shared decision-making with them and hope that, again, at least I kind of started things and they can continue at home and those conversations can continue and hope the kid will eventually get the care that they need.
Talking about youth mental health with Michelle Pickett, an associate professor of pediatrics at the Medical College of Wisconsin, working in the ER as well at Wisconsin Children's. You can join in 800-642-1234. Looking for solutions here. It sounds like capacity and more mental health providers is desperately needed. What types of steps do you see needed in order to address this mental health crisis?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different things that could happen. One thing is needed is kind of this reducing stigma. So we can talk about this. So, you know, conversations that we're having are helpful. But one thing I love about our screening is that it does reduce that stigma. You know, we say we are screening all kids, you know, 10 and older. We're not just singling you out for any reason, and we're showing them that it's okay to talk about these things. So people can be more likely to seek help when they need it. I think our country needs better access to health or mental health care, which I think involves training more professionals, getting more professional people to go into the profession. It's a hard profession. I could not be a mental health specialist or a therapist. You know, they see a lot and it can be taxing on them. So we need to, you know, make it a more desirable career that people want to go into so we can eventually get more people in the profession. I think, you know, that obviously takes commitment from, you know, and funding, commitment from the government or whatnot to kind of make that money available to do that. But I think it's going to be a long process. Unfortunately, I don't see this getting better in the near future. But while we're waiting for that, we're going to do everything we can at Children's to do our part and play our role.
Dr. Pickett, we have less than a minute left, but I would imagine some of that access to mental health care and the lack of clinicians, you know, I think it must be not only taxing that they see a lot, but that they could always see more, that there is a never-ending overtaxing in their job. What effect does that have when you know that the demand far exceeds what you can provide?
Yeah, you know, and I'm not a therapist, so I can't speak on their behalf, but personally, it's hard because, you know, when I see these kids and I know I'm not doing, you know, giving them all that they need, that I can't provide them everything and make it all go away. And then knowing that, you know, a few patients later, it's the same thing is going to happen. It takes a toll on you. And luckily, I have a great work family, and we're able to talk about things and, you know, lean on each other for support when we need it.
Dr. Pickett, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Michelle Pickett is an emergency medicine physician at Children's Wisconsin and an associate professor of pediatrics at the Medical College of Wisconsin. If you or someone you know is in need of help, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 800-273-8255, or text HOME to the crisis text line. That's 741-741. Ahead this hour, we explore new ways to address the health epidemic with a pair of experts. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on children in distress and teens struggling with mental health. What is being done about this crisis here in Wisconsin and nationwide? And this is a sensitive conversation about suicide on the morning show, so please take care. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Bring your experiences as a parent to a child who is struggling. Maybe you're a young person who needs support and has valuable insights to share. What made all the difference? Join in 800-642-1234. Joshua Mirsky is a professor of social work at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee, co-founded the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being. Josh, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much, Kate.
Good morning. Linda Hall here as well, director of the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health. Linda, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Good to be with you and with Josh.
Good morning. Well, Linda, can you lay it out for us? What are you finding? What are you discovering about our Wisconsin youth and suicide attempts?
Well, I think that what we know for sure is that the attempts are up. I was listening in to Dr. Pickett and really support everything that she was saying. We know that there are more attempts. We also know that their kids are a little more willing to talk about this issue about mental health. And we know that there is much that needs to be done. We need to really get to the issues that kids are dealing with before they end up in the ER. And we know that even as the Surgeon General has said, that even before the pandemic, the levels of anxiety and depression and suicide attempts had been increasing for years. So this is, it's not a new problem, but it's certainly been exacerbated by the pandemic.
Yes, the literature seems to suggest, and your data really pointing this as well, that youth mental health, that this crisis was obviously here before the pandemic set in. But how has the pandemic really made this a lot worse?
Well, you know, kids' connections to supportive adults, to teachers, to friends are all vital for their development and for their feeling well, you know, their mental well-being. And so the separation that kids experienced has been really hard on them. And that's some of what we're focusing on as the response to how do we get things on a better track. But the, you know, this track of increased anxiety has been going on for 10 years. And in Wisconsin, kids match pretty much what's happening in the nation. But we have a suicide rate that's higher than national average. And that's also been the case for 10 years. So we definitely have work to do to get kids some help. And I can talk a little bit more later about how we are planning to do that through really focusing on the social connections that kids have.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in a moment. Josh, I want to bring you in here. What's coming up for you? What are you seeing in the pandemic?
Well, it's a great question, Kate. I'll just echo what Linda said and certainly what Dr. Pickett said earlier. We are seeing a rise in mental health disturbances, not only in the child and youth population, but also in the adult population. There are a lot of complex factors contributing to that in children. certainly I would echo what Linda said about social isolation. Peers are a key support system for children and adolescents, and they have been separated from those supports. And that's, you know, certainly contributed to the rise that we're seeing, coupled with, you know, various other factors that preceded the pandemic, including increased smartphone use, sleep deprivation, et cetera.
You are involved in this five-year initiative called the Trauma and Recovery Project. And so this is in Milwaukee and Racine professionals being taught to improve access to trauma-responsive treatments for children. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're doing here?
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you. Yes. Yeah, so our work at the Institute and much of my work actually focuses on a specific subpopulation of children and youth. These are children who grow up in impoverished communities, and particularly who grow up in households where they've been exposed to significant adversity and trauma. And these are the children and youth that are at the greatest risk of serious mental health difficulties. And so part of the problem is that these children are at the greatest risk of mental health challenges, and yet they often reside in communities where there are mental health professional shortages. And so what we try to do with this project and some of our other work is to remove barriers to care, to reduce disparities in care, increase equity to care. And part of that is through systems change. And in fact, in this particular project you mentioned, the Trauma and Recovery Project, we worked with the Office of Children's Mental Health, as well as Children's Wisconsin and the Department of Children and Families, to increase the pool of clinicians who are trained in the kinds of high quality evidence-based therapies that are known to address mental health disturbances that are linked to trauma. And I'd be, again, like Linda said, I'd be happy to talk more about that project in detail if time permits.
We just hear the echoes of it so often, Josh, that we need more providers. We need more clinicians.
Yes.
And that must weigh heavily on you, you know, in your profession, teaching social work.
That's an interesting question. Yes, it is an issue. So one thing that we've done at UWM in our School of Social Work is that we actually have a trauma-informed care certificate program where we train would-be clinicians who come out of our Masters of Social Work program in sort of some of the cutting-edge technologies, if you will, to help address some of these challenges that we see in the population. The needs are so great. Unfortunately, the supply has just not kept up with the need.
Hmm. Talking about the state of youth mental health in Wisconsin, Josh Mirsky there. Linda Hall is here as well. Josh, professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee. Linda Hall, director of the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Linda, you mentioned social connectedness of youth and your work at your office and emphasizing how to be socially connected to support teens and adolescents. What role does social connection have in reducing the risk of self-harm or suicide?
So, good question there, Kate. We know that we landed on this issue of social connectedness because we looked at the data on what's happening with kids and what makes a difference. And we really determined that we know that when there is a connection between when kids feel like they belong and at school and in their community, and whether they engage in risky behaviors, which can include suicide. It can be other things too. It could be drug use, other things. So we really wanted to see, you know, what are the things we can do to help kids feel more like they belong? We've identified five categories of connections. And we're going to pursue encouraging people to increase their connections with kids so that they really feel like they're safe, that they're cared for, and they're valued. And so we are launching a whole initiative around that. And we have also convened a whole group of people to help us really define how does this play out in terms of a community. I wanted to also say that as we looked for new partners to launch this agenda, we also are looking at what's happening at the other end of the age spectrum. there is a lot of energy around reducing social isolation for older adults. And so we are pairing up with those folks that there's already a statewide coalition around that. We're going to pair up with those folks and try to, bring these two issues together, at least be running, be conscious of each other, doing things together so that we are really solving two problems at once, the social isolation that older people feel and what younger people feel, bring some more of them more together.
Oh, that's really interesting. Can you go a little bit deeper there on, you know, who would your partners be in communities to address the social connectedness and to try to launch these type of initiatives?
So we are engaging with a lot of different community-based organizations, Boys and Girls Clubs, after-school programs. We operate through a collective impact approach to our work. And so there are collective impact initiatives in other parts of the state. So we're going to really, we're going to look to these community organizations that are already working with kids. And then we're also going to be talking to aging specialists, aging and disability resource centers in communities, and community centers that serve the aging, and seeing, you know, what are the opportunities to bring these two different ends of the spectrum together. We don't think we have all the answers. We're looking to, to bring up and raise up what is going well in communities, and then just encourage, you know, people to do more. What more can you do? And what can individuals do as well as organizations? And when we look at community, we want to really see that all kids in the community feel valued. We know that in the mental health field, we don't have enough mental health professionals, but we all for sure don't have enough mental health professionals from that represent the cultures of the kids in our schools and in our communities. And so we want to see what more can communities do to make those kids feel like they really belong.
Linda Hall leads the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health. Josh Mirsky with a social work professor at UW-Milwaukee. Join in on prevention, on treatment, barriers for children and teens to get the help they need in Wisconsin. 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this in a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with health experts on the youth mental health crisis that is unfolding in our country and here in Wisconsin, where you see one in three teens reporting feeling sad or hopeless almost every day in 2019. That's from Linda Hall's office. She leads Wisconsin's Office of Children's Mental Health. Also here, social work professor Josh Mirsky. He co-founded the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being at UW-Milwaukee. Share how this conversation hits home, 800-642-1234. And please take care as we discuss suicide this hour. Let's bring in Jean now in Ashland. Hi, Jean. Go ahead. What would you like to bring up?
Well, I would like some advice as a grandmother of a 17-year-old girl who may come probably will stay with us part of the summer. She has a history of different types of trauma, parents divorced, parents remarried, living with the other grandparents, living with us, bullied at school, beat up at school, a lovely, lovely young woman. She's now unable to go to school because of her anxiety and wants to drop out as a junior. Anyway, troubled times. So, and has a history of cutting. So I'm asking you, should I leave the past alone or should I encourage her to talk to grandma because I'm non-judgmental?
Jean, thank you for sharing that. Josh Mirsky, go ahead.
Well, it's a wonderful question. I first just want to thank the caller for sharing, disclosing her experiences, and for the support that she's providing to her granddaughter. I don't think there's a pat answer to what she's asking. The kind of disclosure that she's talking about can be done successfully with family members in a safe and trusting relationship, which it sounds like she might have. What I want to emphasize, I guess, two points. Number one, there are professional services, of course, mental health providers, and specific techniques that these providers use that can engage children and youth in the kinds of exploratory work that she's talking about, exploring past experiences, linking it with present symptoms, and trying to sort of think about a better future with these children. The other thing, though, I wanted to mention is just the fact that the caller has this strong, stable relationship with the child, that in and of itself is incredibly important for, in all likelihood, for the youth's mental health. And what we do know is, as Linda has suggested, that those kinds of strong social connections are really the bedrock of good mental health. And the good thing is that the kinds of support that she's providing just in the natural environment will ultimately not only contribute positively to her granddaughter's mental health, but those effects will generalize beyond her direct interactions. In other words, she'll be able to carry those lessons forward, those gains forward, into other environments.
Linda, thoughts from you?
Yeah, I would just add to what Josh has said, I'm going to say something I know you've heard me say before, Kate, is that a really important thing to do is to spend a few minutes every day listening to your young person. You know, if it's only 5 minutes a day, just listen, open listening, no judgment, you know, no agenda. That can be really important in terms of opening that line of communication and learning from the young person what's really on their mind, because that's an important thing to do. I would hope that this young person has some connection with a mental health professional. And if she does, perhaps that could be continued through the summer through a telehealth arrangement. So doing a session over Zoom.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then we also have information on our website on how to access mental health. It's kind of a map for parents. And maybe that would be a useful tool for maybe not Jean, but maybe the parents.
Jean, thank you so much, and take care. Joe now in Chippewa Falls. Joe, hi, what would you like to bring up?
Good morning. I'm wondering if the guests could talk a little bit more about the role of smartphones. I'm a retired school teacher, and I noticed that when smartphones became widespread a decade ago, it had a significant effect on my students' behavior. They would rather stare at the screens than talk to the people around them, and it seemed to increase the level of passivity. I'm wondering if they have any comments about this.
Joe, thank you. Josh, what have you seen?
So I can tell you from what the research suggests that Joe's personal experience bears out in the literature. The rapid rise in mental health difficulties that we've seen tracks pretty conspicuously with increased use of the smartphone, all the way dating back to, say, 2011. Certainly, that's not the only cause, right? There are multiple factors at play here, but the evidence is pretty clear that increased smartphone use, and particularly problematic smartphone use, high amounts of usage, contributes to poor mental health in youth.
Linda, what about those smartphones and how you've seen that impede connectedness?
Yeah, I would agree with Josh in terms of what the research says. There seems to be a strong connection between the use of smartphones and the declining mental health of kids. We have recently issued a fact sheet on healthy screen use in a digital age. And so in studying it, what we found is that a certain amount of screen use is good, because especially during the pandemic, it has been the connections between peers, which has really been important. But when you have too many hours of screen use and too much using of social media that presents bad images or makes you feel bad about your own image, that's where the problem is. Some people are kind of talking about the Goldilocks rules. So you want to use a little screen time, but don't use too much. Mm. And our fact sheet, which also has suggestions for parents on how to try to limit screen use, is available on our website, which is children.wi.gov.
Joe, thank you for that question as we talk with Linda Hall, director of the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health, Josh Mirsky, professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee, and you and your experiences with children under mental health crisis, 800-642-1234. Linda, you mentioned being an organization, an agency that's really working on collective impact and going into communities and seeing, you know, what can you boost up? What can you work with? And I'm just wondering, as you know, more than a third of people in Wisconsin live in an area that doesn't have enough mental health professionals. What can be done in those circumstances for you to get these advancements made, and yet in areas that simply don't have enough mental health providers?
Well, thanks for that question, Kate. You know, we haven't talked yet this morning about mental health supports at schools. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's really important. We know that we have a mental health professional shortage. We're not going to solve that problem soon. So we really need to look at getting upstream. And one of the ways we can do that is by increasing support for mental health programming at schools. So therapists going into the schools, other kinds of mental health literacy and support programs. And so we are involved in that in a lot of ways. And we have been talking with youth who tell us that they have very clear ideas about what they need in terms of mental health literacy at school and how they want to work on these issues. So we have been talking with them. They're very clear that they want schools that are welcoming and normalize mental health treatment. And also they're looking for adults to be able to talk with them comfortably about mental health and to know what resources to refer them to that when they need them or when their friends need them. Mm. We also know that there are, we have been cataloging youth-led mental health programs at schools. And we have found 135 so far, and we are going to be supporting those to increase. One of the evidence-based programs that people might want to look into is Sources of Strength, which is a program that is evidence-based around preventing suicide, but it also goes beyond that into helping to develop positive cultures in school, which really gets us back to that belonging issue. When, you know, we could create a more positive climate at school, kids are going to feel more like they belong and be mentally healthier.
Well, Josh,
we have a map of the existing programs on our website.
Great. Josh and Linda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Linda Hall, director of the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health, Josh Mirsky, UW-Milwaukee professor of social work. Earlier, we talked with ER physician Michelle Pickett at Wisconsin Children's. If you or someone you know is in need of help, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 800-273-8255. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.